This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Emily Burke. Tonight, the COVID risk spreads to regional New South Wales, with a testing blitz now underway across three country towns. Also, increasing alarm that transport workers moving international travellers through Australia's hotel quarantine system aren't getting enough protective gear.
Still, we have these pretty key workers, our first line of defence, being given inappropriate respiratory protection. So it's no wonder that they are succumbing to this infection and then going on to seed community clusters.
And the economy's still battered, but several industries are hiring again. We'll find out where the jobs are.
Trade and services, healthcare and hospitality, they would account for a large proportion of the opportunities that exist now.
So we're seeing some movement, particularly in payroll and credit control. So there's areas of accounting that are moving, also in logistics and warehousing as well.
The frantic effort to get as many people tested as possible is now ramping up in country New South Wales after a man who contracted coronavirus in Western Sydney travelled on to Orange and Broken Hill in the state's west. The 18-year-old picked up the virus at a suburban bottle shop, which is at the centre of a growing cluster in Sydney, before heading out of town on a camping trip. New South Wales has reported another four locally acquired cases today, while in Victoria, the was three. They're not big numbers, but both states are anxious about how the outbreaks are moving. David Sparks has more.
The town of Orange, 250 kilometres west of Sydney, is all of a sudden on high alert after a man travelled there while infected with COVID-19. Authorities are today pleading with locals to get tested, and many have done just that. One of them was local Mayor Reg Kidd.
All the health authorities and council and everyone else is concerned is letting everybody know to get tested. So there will be a spike in testing, but we can cope with those because we've got two stations actually where people can test. One is the local hospital and we have another one set up at our showground.
I imagine there's a bit of a queue.
Oh, yeah, but nothing like in Sydney or unfortunately what people have been through down in Victoria. When I was out there a while ago, look, if there was, say, I looked at the line, if there was, say, a lineup of 20 or 30 cars, that'd be max. And once you go through, they put them in a couple of different lanes. So there's been no major hold-ups time-wise, no.
One of the drive-through testing clinics in Orange is run by Laverty Pathology. Its general manager is Matthew Bundy.
We're up to about 250 requests currently per day. And over the last 4 weeks, we've been averaging around 100 a day. So definitely increasing capacity so far today.
The 18-year-old man picked up the virus at a BWS bottle shop in the Western Sydney suburb of Barella on Christmas Eve. Without knowing he was infectious, he then headed off on a camping trip through Orange, Ningen and Broken Hill. But the New South Wales Chief Health Officer, Kerry Chant, says far from doing the wrong thing, the young man should be applauded.
Now, can I thank this individual? This individual got a text from us saying you'd been at that BWS on the 24th. Woke up, had a little bit of a runny nose yesterday, and then went out and got a test and did the right thing. So this gentleman was totally unaware of the issues, acted promptly on our text message, and thank you so much because that helps us prevent any further transmission.
A massive testing effort is now underway in the towns he visited. New South Wales recorded 8 new cases in the latest update. 4 of those were in hotel quarantine. The other 4 were locally acquired, and 3 of those are linked to the Barella bottle shop. That cluster is now up to 15 cases. The state's health minister, Brad Hazzard, says 26,000 tests were conducted yesterday, but he wants more.
But particularly our focus is also in Western and Southwestern Sydney. Obviously, the issue at Barella continues to be of high concern for New South Wales Health and the government. I want to say particularly to the people of Western and Southwestern Sydney, thank you so much for coming out in increased numbers. But we still need more. We need many more to come out and be tested. It is crucial for us, for New South Wales Health, to be able to be certain that we don't have chains of transmission that we're failing to identify.
Police in New South Wales have been issuing fines to people for failing to wear masks when required. Mr Hazzard says he has little sympathy.
I heard someone who's received a couple of fines now talk about the fact that was quoted in the media as saying, I've had two, I'm a double negative. Well, no. If you've been told to self-isolate for 14 days, that is done for a solid public health reason. And simply getting a couple of tests doesn't cut it. It does not cut it. If you're told to self-isolate for 14 days, self-isolate. Or every time you put your foot out the door, there'll be a policeman there and potentially you're going to be fined again.
Victoria recorded four new locally acquired cases overnight. Three of those are linked to a cafe in the Bayside suburb of Black Rock in Melbourne. The state's COVID-19 response commander is Jerome Waymar.
And we know that the virus works in unpredictable ways. We've seen the Black Rock exposure site where 12 people went to one cafe on one night from, I think, five different groups and all contracted the virus from each other. And we have other exposure sites where, to date, we've not seen any of those transmissions come across. Our testing penetration on those exposure sites is very good, so we're pretty confident we're getting an accurate picture.
But he says the last week has shown the dangers of complacency.
We have to keep driving hard at this, and you know we will not rest until we've tested everybody around these exposure sites and until we've gone through a number of cycles of the virus to establish that we really have stamped out this particular outbreak and identified any other change of transmission that may still be out there.
Victoria's COVID-19 response commander, Jerome Waymar. David Sparks with that report. Sport is again one of the big casualties of COVID-19 outbreaks in Australia. There are concerns that the Australian Grand Prix may be postponed, with the race under threat due to strict travel restrictions. The Australian Open too has hit a snag, with one hotel lined up to host tennis players now off the list after local residents threatened legal action. And residents in some of Sydney's hotspot suburbs have been banned from the third test at the SCG and threatened with fines if they try their luck. Caroline Winter reports.
For the players at the Auburn District Cricket Club in Sydney's West, the third test between Australia and India at the SCG was to be a memorable start to the new year. Michael Wood is the club's executive officer.
Auburn itself, the club, has a number of players of Indian heritage who are very passionate about their cricket and support the Indian cricket team with a passion.
But he says that passion has been dealt a blow. That's because residents from Berala and surrounding suburbs are now banned from going to the test because of several COVID cases connected to a supermarket and bottle shop in the area.
I believe they'll be very devastated by that they cannot attend the Sydney test, which would be the highlight of their season, to go and watch the Indians and support their Indian cricket team. That will definitely hit them hard, yeah.
Is it something that many of them will have been looking forward to for quite some time?
Oh, definitely. They would have seen the program out 12 months ago and been planning on going.
Instead, they'll watch the test at home. And New South Wales Health Minister Brad Hazzard says anyone from Auburn, Berala, Lidcombe North, Potts Hill, Regent's Park or Rookwood caught at the SCG risks a fine.
We would love in any other year, a non-COVID year, to have you at the test. But we can't, for your sake and for the community's sake. So please be aware, the SCG have asked you not to come, but it will be backed in, because if a police officer stops you and you happen to be at the SCG, then you will find yourself receiving a $1,000 fine.
Michael Wood doesn't expect that will be an issue.
In our area, in the Auburn, Lidcombe sort of area, they're hard working, you have a low income sort of scale, and they couldn't afford those sort of fines, as much as they love their cricket.
The third test is scheduled to start on Thursday with the crowd limit at 25% capacity, or around 10,000 people per day. But it's not just cricket fans missing out. It could be deja vu for Formula One fans again this year, who last March, at the start of the pandemic, were left devastated after the Melbourne race was cancelled last minute.
Got a time of f***ing earlier!
It's terrible, especially with the tourists and people who travel far away.
Come on, man, I flew 28 hours to come here.
I hope they give us a refund.
10 months on, and there are talks the Australian Formula One Grand Prix may be postponed. The season opener is scheduled for the 21st of March in Melbourne, but it could instead open a week later at the Bahrain Grand Prix. Victorian Police Minister Lisa Neville says talks are still underway between the Victorian government and F1 management.
As far as I know, there's been no decision that has been made to cancel, move or otherwise with the Australian Grand Prix. Those conversations are live and active, absolutely, about the Grand Prix in 2021.
The Victorian government has also been forced to bat away criticism over plans to quarantine Australian Open tennis players at a luxury hotel in Melbourne. The Westin in the CBD was among those where international stars were set to spend 14 days prior to the Grand Slam next month. But residents in the hotel's penthouse apartments say they weren't consulted, and some older residents were worried about the health risks. Lisa Neville says it's now been sorted.
This is about having goodwill with our hotel partners. We don't want to be in that position. We're also concerned this may delay the standing up of the Australian Open. So we've gone through a process of securing a new site.
She says a full list of the contracted hotels will be announced next week.
Caroline Winter reporting. Well, Australia has around 280 active cases across the country, and new infections have been creeping up in the single digits. It's a stark contrast to the spiralling situation in the UK, almost 60,000 new cases there today, forcing Britain into a third national lockdown. And so now there are questions about whether Australia should consider suspending flights from the UK. To take a look, a closer look at the developments locally and overseas, I spoke to Monash University's infectious diseases expert and physician at Alfred Health, Associate Professor Michelle Anandaraja.
I'm most concerned about the lack of precaution that has been taken with border control and first responders, as well as the very real risk of escape into the community. So, for example, we've seen how transport workers have been acquiring COVID, and, you know, questions really need to be asked as to why bus drivers are being given surgical masks when they're transporting people between venues.
What would you suggest?
We know that we've known, you know, since February, March, that this virus is airborne. That seems to be the dominant mode of transmission. And still, we have pretty key workers, our first line of defence, being given inappropriate respiratory protection. So it's no wonder that they are succumbing to this infection.
Is it a resource issue, do you think? Not enough, perhaps, of
absolutely
the higher-grade masks?
No, this has got nothing to do with resourcing. Australia has, you know, apart from the Victorian second wave, we have dodged a big fat bullet with respect to COVID. So we have had, you know, relatively low community transmission of the virus. And the good thing about that is that it hasn't put, you know, an undue strain on our PPE supplies.
There are calls for changes to the testing and quarantining of international air crew. Should that be a priority? Would it make a difference to the strength of the hotel quarantine arrangements?
I think it's great that Victoria has raised this on a national level, because we now have in the mix the mutant variant strain from the UK. So this, you know, can take essentially a spot fire and turn it into a wildfire because of the exponential way this virus is spread. And it doesn't go from, you know, 10 to 50 to 100. It goes from 10 to 100 to 1,000 to 10,000 to 100,000 in a matter of, you know, weeks to months. So we need to get on top of this quickly. And if the international crew members have been identified as being at high risk, then, yeah, I fully support the government's measures to try and lock this down.
Should Australia go even further and close its borders to the UK for the time being?
I don't know what the answer is. I don't feel that we need to jump straight to locking down or banning travel from the UK, because if that means that we can't bring Aussies home, that is a problem. That's a huge problem. We need to bring our people back. But it does mean that we need to tighten up our controls.
You look at what's happening in the UK, you look at the graphs of the cases that are growing, it's not really a curve, it's a vertical line up. It's deteriorating rapidly. There is a new lockdown, but that's not really going to start to bear any fruit for a couple of weeks. What are you hearing from your colleagues in medicine and your connections in the UK?
The situation in the UK is absolutely diabolical right now. It is, the NHS is under intense pressure. What you are seeing and witnessing is the collapse of a health system in a well-resourced, highly developed country. And, you know, we shouldn't think for a minute that this can't happen here. It could happen here if we don't get control of disease transmission. Look, it is actually frightening, because I have a lot of family, extended family, who are frontline workers in the UK, and they are absolutely under the pump right now.
What do they say to you? What do they tell you?
Oh, that their hospitals are full. They're also getting to a point where they're running out of oxygen in the hospital, which means that apart from the fact that they couldn't actually intubate patients and send them to intensive care, they also couldn't turn the oxygen up any further for those patients who couldn't get a breathing tube put down. And entire teams are down with COVID, are sick themselves. And so, you know, it's put intense pressure on the remaining staff who are already exhausted and near breaking point. So what these healthcare workers are getting in the UK now is they're getting the Pfizer vaccine.
Can and should Australians be getting vaccinated when the emergency is so obviously much more acute in the Northern Hemisphere?
Yeah, absolutely. So the situation is different in Australia, isn't it? However, you know, our lives are heavily disrupted. We're living with great uncertainty because we have an imperfect hotel quarantine system and we have an imperfect, you know, public health response. It's good. It's a lot better than it was, but it's not perfect. And we all know that. And so quite rightly, many people, including myself, are questioning why we are waiting so long to have the vaccine rolled out.
Associate Professor Michelle Anandaraja from Monash University there. And you're listening to PM on radio, on the ABC Listen app and via podcast. I'm Emily Burke. Ahead, with Julian Assange's extradition to the US off the table for now, should the Australian government do anything to support him?
And I call again on the Australian Prime Minister for him to pick up the phone and to talk some sense into Boris Johnson and to Donald Trump, and to implore them very, very strongly to allow the man to go free, to be with his family in London.
President Trump has flown into the southern US state of Georgia in the final hours of campaigning for two crucial Senate seats. It's not yet known if his appearance will help or hinder the Republican Party's chances. Some in his party are worried that false claims of electoral fraud in the presidential race may serve to keep voters away from the polling booths in Georgia. President-elect Joe Biden has urged voters in Georgia to break the gridlock by giving the Democrats the control of the Senate. Rachel Mealy reports.
It might be the last campaign rally President Trump will address for a while, and he didn't waste any time getting to his talking points.
Well, I want to thank you very much. Hello, Georgia. By the way, there's no way we lost Georgia. There's no way. That was a rigged election.
The runoff elections in Georgia are for two Senate seats. In last November's election, no candidate won more than 50% of the vote, and under Georgia's rules, the elections need to be run again to pick the winners. The control of the US Senate for the next 2 years is up for grabs, and both parties are throwing everything they've got at the outcome. President-elect Joe Biden told a rally in Atlanta his administration can get things done if the Democrats control the Senate.
Georgia, the whole nation is looking to you. The power is literally in your hands. Unlike any time in my career, one state can chart the course, not just for the next 4 years, but for the next generation.
Joe Biden was flanked by the Democratic candidates John Ossoff and Reverend Raphael Warnock, who's a Baptist preacher. If he wins his seat, he'd become Georgia's first ever black senator. For the Republican Party, the past 2 days haven't been ideal. A leaked recording of a phone call between President Trump and Georgia's Secretary of State diverted attention from the Senate races.
This is a faulty election result, and honestly, this should go very fast. You should meet tomorrow because you have a big election coming up. And because of what you've done to the president, you know, the people of Georgia know that this was a scam. And because of what you've done to the president, a lot of people aren't going out to vote.
The fallout from the phone call prompted Georgia's election officials to come out swinging at the president in an attempt to restore confidence in tomorrow's voting process. Gabrielle Sterling is a Republican who's in charge of Georgia's voting systems.
This is all easily, provably false. Yet the president persists.
At the rally in Georgia, Republican candidate Senator Kelly Loeffler stood beside President Trump, but the other candidate, Senator David Perdue, was obeying doctor's orders to isolate because he'd been exposed to someone with coronavirus. Donald Trump repeated his false claims that votes were stolen in large numbers to deny him the election.
If the Liberal Democrats take the Senate and the White House, and they're not taking this White House, we're going to fight like hell, I'll tell you right now.
Traditionally, under America's non-compulsory voting system, it's harder to get voters to turn up for a runoff election. But this time, both parties have been spending big on advertising to keep voters' attention focused. Republican pollster Whit Ayres told The World Today both Senate races are too close to call.
It's very difficult to figure out how those countervailing forces work. Everybody seems to think right now that both races are very, very close.
3 million people have already voted in the election. That's about 40% of registered voters. Officials say they'll be able to count the votes quickly, but if it's down to the wire, recounts might be on the cards once again.
Rachel Mealy reporting. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is set to stay in the UK for now after a court ruled against a US request to extradite him. But his supporters are hoping they're one step closer to seeing him free. Among them, Australian politicians from across the political spectrum who've been campaigning for the extradition request to be dropped. But legal experts say the process has a long way to go yet. Political reporter Claudia Long has more.
As supporters of Julian Assange celebrated the quashing of the US request for his extradition in the UK, on Australian soil, backers of the controversial whistleblower are breathing a sigh of relief too.
I think we should celebrate as far as we've got here. This is good news.
Tasmanian Independent MP Andrew Wilkie has been a long-time supporter of the WikiLeaks founder, whose mental health has deteriorated so badly, the court ruled against the request to extradite him.
This is just hard evidence of what we've been saying all along, that the man has taken a terrible toll and is a wreck.
Julian Assange remains behind bars in the UK, where Andrew Wilkie, along with coalition backbencher George Christensen, visited him last year.
It's where the UK imprisons the worst of the worst. And I call again on the Australian Prime Minister, who claims to have a very good relationship with the US and the UK administrations, for him to pick up the phone.
We now think it's time for the Morrison government to make a request of the US government to bring this to an end.
Labor's Shadow Attorney General Mark Dreyfus is joining the call for the government to get in touch with US authorities and ask for the extradition request to be dropped.
That's not something that Labor can do from opposition. It is something that the Morrison government, recognising what's happened, recognising all the circumstances of this case, recognising that a British judge has shown mercy, it's a matter for the Morrison government to now do what it can for this Australian citizen.
And he says there's precedent for the request to be rescinded.
A previous US administration decided not to pursue Mr. Assange.
So far, the government isn't committing to making further requests of either the US or UK governments on behalf of Julian Assange. Here's what Prime Minister Scott Morrison had to say on the matter on 2GB earlier today.
He's going through those processes. Consular support has consistently been offered to Mr. Assange, so that would be a matter for him.
The ABC put questions to the Office of Foreign Minister Maurice Payne, asking whether the government intends to make the representations her colleagues in the Parliament are calling for. Those questions weren't specifically addressed, but in a statement, a spokesperson for the minister said,
Australia is not a party to the case and will continue to respect the ongoing legal process, including the UK justice system's consideration of applications for release or any appeals. We have made 19 offers of consular assistance to Mr. Assange since 2019 that have gone unanswered. We will continue to offer consular support.
We are entering this really interesting twilight phase of politics and law combining, and Australia certainly has a capacity to make representations on behalf of Assange to the outgoing Trump administration, but most importantly to the incoming Biden administration.
Professor of International Law at the Australian National University, Donald Rothwell, has been closely following the extradition hearing. He thinks while this saga has stretched on for almost 8 years now, calls from Australian politicians might actually make a difference.
These matters are arising when we're seeing a transition from the Trump administration to the Biden administration. It falls within the remit of the Trump administration to discontinue these proceedings. It very much would fall within the remit of the new Biden administration.
But that doesn't mean we're in for a speedy process.
The appeal processes could be quite tortuous and work their way through a number of different courts as they meander through the UK legal system.
And Julian Assange could still spend a big portion of that time in jail.
Julian Assange broke the conditions of his previous bail orders as a result of him seeking to defeat his Swedish arrest warrant back in 2012. So unfortunately, he has a form under the UK legal system of not complying with bail conditions.
Professor of International Law Donald Rothwell, ending that report by Claudia Long. Well, there's some hope on the economic front today. The closely watched ANZ Bank Job Ads Index, which is used to gauge just how hungry companies are for workers, rose 9% in December, after rising 13% in November. Economists say if the number of job ads keeps climbing, the official unemployment rate could fall quite quickly. So, where are the jobs? Our business reporter David Taylor has the story.
Melbourne-based sales rep Melanie Olson lost her job in May during the height of the coronavirus economic crisis. Business at the firm where she was selling medical record-keeping services all but dried up.
It was hard because obviously we had no income. We went dropped down to one income. So, yeah, it was very hard.
For months, she applied for at least two jobs per week, often hearing nothing back.
Because no one was hiring and I was either overqualified or underqualified. So it was very difficult.
But making ends meet became easier about 5 weeks ago when she landed a job. She's still in sales, now working in the laminate industry, liaising with builders and construction companies.
Very, very relieved. Very, very relieved, yes. So it was putting a big strain on our family, being on one wage. So it's a massive relief in this climate to be able to find a job.
Research from the ANZ Bank shows Melanie Olson was part of a wave of new hires in November and December. Job ads, as measured by the bank, rose by 9.2% in December to an 18-month high. Senior ANZ economist Catherine Birch says the lift in hiring intentions should translate to a spike in job creation and lower levels of unemployment in coming months.
But we do think it would have to exceed the pre-pandemic levels for some time, for several months, we think, to entrench that solid labour market recovery and bring the unemployment rate down.
So how much momentum is behind this new wave of hiring? Well, recruiter Mark Smith says the phones began ringing hot again in November when news of a coronavirus vaccine hit the headlines. But he warns January is always a quiet month.
I would expect that the market won't be quite as buoyant as we come into 21.
When business picks up again and hiring managers head back to the office, Mark Smith says he's expecting more calls from these industries.
Particularly in payroll and credit control, so there's areas of accounting that are moving, also in logistics and warehousing as well.
JobAds website Seek's employment analyst Lee Broderick agrees and says these industries will also be hiring.
The demand, if you look on site at the moment, is mostly made up with trade and services, healthcare and hospitality. So they would account for a large proportion of the opportunities that exist now. But we've actually seen through the hospitality sector, so chefs and waiters, bar staff, quite strong demand as restrictions have come off, and that has continued right through to the Christmas period.
While some industries are seeing higher demand for their products and services and need to bring more workers on as a result, other industries remain under threat from coronavirus lockdowns. Economist Catherine Birch also warns the end of JobKeeper, currently slated for March, could also see many workers flip from JobKeeper to JobSeeker, lifting the unemployment rate.
Particularly if we think about businesses who are reliant on international tourism, interstate tourism as well, particularly given the border shutdowns as have happened recently again. International education, aviation as well. A lot of office buildings still empty at the moment, and a lot of businesses that would usually service office workers in capital cities not having that that market at the moment.
Regardless of which industry you're in, though, Seek's Lee Broderick has a tip or two for job candidates who want to stand out.
What you want to be able to convey through your application process is that you have understood what they're looking for. So what are the skills and attributes that the hirer really needs?
And recruiter Mark Smith says even if it's abundantly clear you can perform the role, you may miss out because another candidate is a better fit. He says that's what leads to most candidate disappointment.
So they may be pipped at the post because somebody else has industry experience. Although they can do the job, they may not be the best person for the job. So they've got to be realistic that it is a competitive marketplace out there.
The official unemployment rate will be released later this month.
Business reporter David Taylor. Thanks for joining me for PM this evening. I'm Emily Burke. Thanks for your company. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. But for now, good night.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.